Well, it's great to be here. Thanks. I usually get the after lunch slot when everyone's kind of sleeping off lunch, so I feel pretty good about this. This is a pretty positive thing so far. Monday morning, bright and early. I don't have to wait till after lunch. Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Plugfest. I got to say, I'm jealous. When I looked at the agenda outside, I used to work on the networking team at Microsoft once upon a time. I used to watch SMB and RPC packets and network monitor 8 hours a day. And then later in my career, I actually worked in the core development team and the operating systems division on networking. So I owned such famous protocols as SNMP for a while and a bunch of the core networking protocols. So I learned a lot there. The best networking people tend to be networking, or sorry, the best security people tend to be networking people before they go into security. Because it turns out that about 99% of the hacks that happen over the wire. People tend to not break in the computer sitting right at the keyboard. So today I'm going to walk you through a whole bunch of data that shows you sort of how that happens. I'm sure we've got many networking and security experts in the room, but I'm going to walk you through tons and tons of data here. This would be death by data. We don't need to necessarily make it through it all, but I want to make sure you get your money's worth. And we'll get started here. If you have any questions along the way, please let me know. I'm happy to stop and try to dive deeper into any topic area that that you're interested in. But I do have to say, I'm jealous. I mean, I used to work on protocols. Does anyone here remember some support tools like DNS Lint or Port Query or NB Lookup? Any support tool guys here at all? No? Okay. All right, so let's move on. We'll talk about security this morning, and I'll let the network experts talk to you about networking. We're going to walk through a bunch of data from a new report that we just released. We've been publishing the Microsoft Security Intelligence Report at Microsoft for almost 10 years now. That's what I've been doing since I left the networking world, is working in security. We release this report typically twice a year, once every 6 months. And so we released one probably 3 weeks ago now, volume 18 of the Security Intelligence Report. You'll hear me reference it as the SIR, S-I-R. And you can go up and get, you know, a whole bunch of documentation. I'll give you the URL again at the end of the presentation, but microsoft.com/SIR. Every one of these reports contains data on vulnerabilities, exploits, malware, drive-by downloads, phishing, all of the types of attacks that you read about in the news almost weekly now. And so we'll walk you through a bunch of that. I understand there's people here from different countries around the world, so China, India, United States, and so on. We've got data, deep dive data in our report for over 100 countries, typically around 120 countries. So whether you're from China, India, or somewhere else, we do have deep dives into every single one of those countries. And I do a lot of blogging on this topic as well, a lot of extra analysis and inside baseball. And I'll give you the URL to the blog later. What makes our report a little different from most of the other threat intelligence reports you might read or consume already is where we get our data from. Since Microsoft has, you know, a widely deployed platform out there, Windows and Internet Explorer, we get a lot of data from a lot of different places in the world, and we get different points of view around the data. It's not just sort of one-dimensional. So let's start with anti-malware stuff. So the anti-malware products like System Center Endpoint Protection, Windows Defender on Windows 8, what we call the Malicious Software Removal Tool, or MSRT. The MSRT, for instance, comes down with security updates on the second Tuesday or second Wednesday, depending on where you live in the world, of each month. When the security updates come down, the MSRT is a very small antivirus tool that comes down that was deployed back in the days of SQL Slammer as a Slammer cleanup tool. That was sort of the preface of this MSRT that's been released ever since. It comes down and focuses on the top 200, 250 global threats that we think are out there and are very prevalent, so that folks without antivirus software on their systems, without real-time antivirus software on their systems, at least have some hope of getting disinfected from some of the world's worst Trojan downloaders and bots and that type of thing. So the MSRT runs on usually 600 to 700 million systems every month, And then from there, we get a lot more data from a lot of these other tools you'll see. For instance, Internet Explorer, I mentioned, runs on obviously hundreds of millions of systems. There's a couple of technologies in IE, like the cross-site scripting filter. There's also a smart screen filter, which is essentially antivirus software inside the browser. Now there's a new thing called IEV that allows antivirus vendors to get right into the browser and scan URLs and scan downloads before the browser even loads them on the page. And so we've started to get some new data from that as well that I'll show you a little bit later. But that data, not only does it show us what types of threats that IE users are encountering, but it shows us what type of systems are hosting those threats. So whether it's an Apache box or an IIS box or some other type of browser or IIS server, web server, we get to a little bit more data from IE because it's connecting to all sorts of endpoints and doing all sorts of things like video and parsing and so on. So I'll show you some of the things. Obviously, the browsers is one of the primary ways that computer users get attacked today. And there's a variety of reasons why that is. We'll talk a little bit about that. Then there's some other tools. For instance, Bing isn't listed here, but it turns out that Bing is an awesome security source of security data for us. As it indexes billions of pages, in web pages, so that when you search on search terms, it's able to find those results very quickly, and they're highly relevant and all that good stuff. It's also, as it indexes, looking for drive-by download sites, malware hosting sites, phishing sites, and putting that into a big reputation system. So that when, for instance, email comes to you through another thing here, Exchange Online Protection, we already have a huge cache of IP addresses that are known bad IP addresses. So those IP addresses, when they send email to you through our email filtering system, if they're from a known bad IP address, they just drop them right at the barrier, you know, right at the border. They don't even go into content filtering or any of that stuff. It's just known bad. We're not going to accept it at all. IE users also benefit from that because when they surf to a site that happens to be on that list, IE will block them and say, hey, you shouldn't go to this site, and if you really want to, you have to click on this extra button to get there. So it's a way of trying to protect IE users. If the results show up in a Bing search, it'll also block you from clicking on it and say, hey, if you really want to get to it, you have to click a couple extra times. So it's just a way of warning people about known bad sites that we know are bad, that are serving malware, serving drive-by downloads, and so on. We get an immense amount of data from Bing because, again, it's not just scanning Windows systems, it's scanning and indexing all sorts of systems out there. So it does turn out to be a very rich source of threat intelligence for us. So there's a whole lot of places that we get threat intel. One of the places that we get threat intel from is the Department of Homeland Security NIST database, where they count vulnerability disclosures. So CVEs, common vulnerability exposures. What you see here is the long-term trend, like 9 years of counting common vulnerability exposures, or otherwise known as public vulnerability disclosures. So any vulnerability in software or hardware ultimately gets a CVE number assigned to it, and what we're doing here is just counting all those CVE numbers from all the vulns across the entire industry. Now, until recently, you can see the grand heyday of vulnerability disclosures in the industry was back in like 2008, the second half of 2008. So the way to read this is, you know, 1H06 is the first half of 2006, 2H is the second half of 2006, all the way to the second half of 2014. So the grand heyday was back in 2008, where we saw more than 3,500 vuln disclosures across the entire industry in a six-month period. So that's 7,000 vulnerability disclosures a year. That's huge, right? All the attackers, all they have to do is get a handful of them that are actually exploitable and then go to work. And people that aren't patched for those, or if there's not a patch available for those, people will get exploited. Now, what we're seeing here in the last 6 months of 2014 is a little unprecedented, as you can see. You could go back all the way to 1999 when the CVE database was started and not find a time when vulnerability disclosures went that high in a single period or in any period. So it went up over 50% in that six-month period that you see there. And that's entirely attributed to, almost entirely, there was about 8%. You can see it's actually going up slowly here. So there was without this big spike I'll describe, there was about an 8% increase Now, because we had one vendor, you know, the US CERT coordination team decided to scan the Google Play Store looking for SSL vulnerabilities inside the apps in that Play Store. So when they went and did that, it turns out that they found almost 1,400 CVEs just scanning apps in the Play Store, affecting tens of thousands of apps in that Play Store. So from the Google Play Store, App Store, that's where the spike came from. There was over 50%. Without all of those vulns that they found in there, they're all SSL validation vulns, it would have been about an 8% increase. So still on track to be one of the highest periods of vuln disclosures in the history of counting vuln disclosures, but it really went up because of all those SSL validation disclosures found in the Google Play Store apps. So I mentioned these are SSL validation CVEs, meaning that the apps thought they were validating SSL certificates properly. They weren't, which means that the app is potentially susceptible to a man-in-the-middle attack where someone poses and between the intended connection and the client and pretends to be the intended connection. And since the SSL cert isn't being validated properly, the attack will work and the user won't know about it. All right, so not every vuln is the same, okay? A lot of the CISOs that I talk to around the world, they tend to treat vuln data as if every vuln is the same, they're all equally exploitable, they're all bad, and it's just, you know, this is something that they use to determine whether or not one vendor is better than another. Does Google have more vulns than Microsoft or Apple or Samsung or whomever, okay? And between you and me and the fence post, it's a silly thing to do. Because if everything stayed the same forever, you could count up all the vulns and compare vendors. But how long does everything stay the same for? Oh, it just changed, right? It just changed again. Nothing stays the same, right? So in a world where you have things constantly changing, new products, new updates, service packs, code constantly churning, new products being released, old products being retired, it's a silly comparison to just add up these vulns and say, well, they're doing a better job than these guys. It's silly. So what we try to do is slice and dice the data in a way that's a little bit more thoughtful. So here what you're seeing in the top left is what they call severity. So the highest severity vulnerabilities allow remote code execution, typically wormable. Okay, so those are really, really bad. We'd like to see very, very few of those, but for the most part, the long-term trend actually shows that there's usually more high severity and medium severity vulnerabilities than low severity vulnerabilities. A low severity vulnerability would be something that enables, for instance, information disclosure. So the system disclosed some information that it wasn't designed to disclose. Where, you know, medium and high, for instance, most of those, all of those 1,400, nearly 1,400 CVEs that they found in the Google Play Store were all medium severity. Okay, because they didn't allow remote code execution, they enabled a potential man-in-the-middle attack. Okay, so that gives you kind of an idea what's going on here. So the other thing is, not every vuln is as easy as the next vuln to exploit. And this is where the CISOs, when they compare vendors using vulns, this is where sort of their logic starts to fall down. Some vulns are very, very easy to exploit. And that, on this chart of access complexity, those are the low complexity vulns. So the ones that are easiest to actually exploit or the highest risk, they tend to be, you know, there tends to be more of those than any other. Usually you find more low complexity vulnerabilities than high complexity or medium complexity. Now all those Google vulns I talked about, they're all medium complexity as it turns out. So high complexity means you have to be a brain surgeon to figure out how to write proof of concept code and reliably get the exploit to work. So we'd like to see lots of high complexity vulns. We'd like to see lots of low severity vulns. And the other thing is where are the vulns actually stored? Like what software and hardware do we find the most vulns in? Because there tends to be this, you know, you can go and read this out in, you know, any day of the week in the press, where if we could just get the operating systems right from Microsoft and Apple and Google, and if we could just get the browsers right, this problem would go away. And unfortunately, the long-term trend over 10 years of data suggests that 85 to 98% of the vulns have always been in applications. Okay? They've always been in things that ship other than the operating system. So what I try to do is that very last quadrant in the bottom right there that you see is people sometimes in some markets I'll go to, they'll say, well, if Microsoft just fixed their software, this wouldn't be a problem. This would all go away. Microsoft's portion of these vulnerability disclosures that we're talking about here have trended between 3% and 8% of all the vulns that you see on the chart, which means that 98%, you know, to 93% of the vulns are in other people's software. So the message here is if you're not patching all software from all vendors, if you have vendors actually not offering you updates, you're not getting your money's worth. They're not paying attention. They're not taking care of you. Because nobody can write vuln-free software. As long as humans write software, humans make mistakes. Some of those mistakes will be security vulnerabilities. Some of those vulnerabilities, a small number of them, will be exploitable. And I'll walk you through the exploit data next, because that's way more interesting than vuln data. But don't let some vendor tell you that they don't have vulns in their software because they have the best developers in the world. Okay, we have 36,000 developers at the company. We know a little bit about development. And I can tell you that looking at code, especially in the IoT world today, that a lot of these vendors are shipping their software with hundreds of known vulnerabilities in them. Then they'll sit on the shelf at the hardware store, the electronics store, for another several months without being updated, and then you bring them home and put them on the wall. Okay, this is the world that we're moving into. So what we've been trying to do is get people to pay attention to these numbers and how to drive them down. At Microsoft, we use the security development lifecycle to try to do that. And I've got some data here to show you how that's been working out for us over the last 10 years. So let's talk about exploits, because vulnerabilities are really theoretical. If all vulns were exploitable, and they were all equally exploitable, the access complexity was the same and the severity was the same, then it would be an easy conversation. But in a world where everything constantly changes, you can't use the theoretical to determine where you're going to prioritize your resources. Where's your CISO going to put their money and their resources? Okay? So by looking at what the bad guys are actually exploiting, you get a sense of where they should be putting their resources, a better idea. Okay? It's not perfect, but at least it tells you what's actually being attacked versus what could theoretically be attacked. So first thing is a drive-by download attack. It has been the attacker's favorite attack probably for the last 3 or 4 years at a minimum. I'll just walk you through this so everyone knows what it is. User goes up to a website. That website's been compromised or it's been created to be malicious from the beginning. They're driving traffic to it. The user goes up there, loads the web page. That page, there's a couple of different types of these attacks. So the one I'm showing you here is called an iframe attack. There's another one that's malicious JavaScript. It doesn't matter. There's a few different ways to happen for this to happen. But in this case, when the page loads inside the browser, and it doesn't matter what kind of browser, whether it's made in Cupertino or it's made in Redmond or it's made someplace else, okay? When the browser loads it up, there's an iframe on that page. An iframe can be the size of a pixel, so there's no way to even see it on the page. The iframe goes ahead and says, hey, why don't you go and run this script hosted over on this server over in India? The script loads up and runs. The script determines what operating system you're running and what browser you're running. The next thing that happens is the script says, hey, based on the operating system you're running and the browser you're running, why don't you go and load up these, let's say, 1 to 20 exploits that I have in my exploit library for that operating system and that browser. And if the user isn't actually patched for all of those 20 exploits across their browser, all the browser plugins, the operating system, Office, whatever kind of software they have installed on that system, they get owned. The next thing that happens is we download malware that's hosted in China or somewhere else. Okay, I mentioned China because they have the highest incidence of malware hosting in the world by a long, long margin. So the point here is these attacks are geographically spread out. There's not a single place that all of this is being hosted around the world, and I'll show you some data here. So this is a tough attack to defend against because you have to keep up to date, not just your Microsoft software, but all of your software. That makes it hard. So here you can see in the fourth quarter of 2014 where the most drive-by downloads, these are where the actual download servers are being hosted. Okay, this was step one in that attack. So in step two, I can show you a heat map for every single one of those steps I walked you through. Every component of these attacks are hosted in different parts of the world in different amounts. Okay, so here I mentioned that, over in China they host a lot of malware. There's places, for instance, in Northern Africa and the Middle East, things change dramatically. The Middle East is interesting, right? Because in the Middle East, for instance, in Egypt, or places like Syria or Iraq, they don't tend to have very reliable internet access. So why would you host an attack in a region that has very unreliable internet access? Because that would mean that people wouldn't get, have very reliable way to get to all the malware that you're hosting and trying to get it onto their servers. In fact, it turns out that most of the malware in that region of the world is spread via USB drives by a long, long margin. And again, we have data on over 100 countries in the report to walk you through some of that. So this just gives you, there's lots of exploit kits out there. The exploit kit that paved the road for all of these guys is this so-called black hole exploit kit. I'm sorry, don't want to do that. The so-called black hole exploit kit that, they arrested this guy over in Russia or Ukraine, and all of a sudden the black hole exploit kit almost went down to zero because it's no longer being professionally managed. But these guys, what they're doing is they lease or rent these kits out to whoever wants them. And then as new exploits are found, they put them in the exploit kit. They take out the old exploits that don't work so well anymore because enough people have got patched where they're not being as effective anymore. And now everyone that rents or leases that kit has the benefit of the most recent exploits that have been found. Now, it used to take months for new exploits to find their way into these kits. And today, when we look at the data, it's more like within 10 days. In fact, we're seeing more and more zero-day exploits added to these kits, and a zero-day is an exploit for a vulnerability for which no fix has been released. We're seeing more and more zero-day vulnerabilities being included in these kits. So the first time we see the vuln is when they're in a kit trying to attack a mass number of systems. And once they get onto the system, they typically download malware, as I mentioned, that allows them to remote control the system. Once they can remote control the system, then they can lease or rent the botnet that they're creating for DDoS attacks, spam projects, and so on, hosting illicit content, and so on. All right, so in the report, we go through what the top families are, so I'll give you an example. This one at the very top, this is the so-called Angler exploit kit that contains typically exploits for Silverlight, IE, Adobe, Excel, I mentioned Adobe already, so Flash and PDF and so on. And they constantly change these things out to maximize the number of people that get compromised when they visit a page where this kit is being hosted. All right, so I mentioned that the Angler kit, this just shows you how they come and go. Sometimes you'll see, for instance, this the nuclear one that's going down. Once that typically happens, that usually means that the attacker managing that kit has now deprecated the kit and has moved on with a new kit that's better. And so now they're just letting that one die. That's typically what we see. Okay, so I wanted to run you through some specific exploits. Now, Java was being attacked at scale for years. So 3-4 years, lots of Java attacks. We would see usually between 2.5 and 5 million Java attacks every 90 days. And so over time, you can see that these attacks have come way, way down, and they continue to trend down. And that's because in September of 2014, on Patch Tuesday in September, Microsoft released an update to Internet Explorer 8, 9, 10, and 11 on Windows 7, Windows 8, Server 2008, and Server 2010 that blocked out-of-date Java ActiveX controls. So all of those out-of-date Java controls that were being attacked in those exploit kits for years and years and years, Microsoft and Adobe and Oracle just put their foot down and said, okay, we're going to stop loading out-of-date Java controls inside Internet Explorer, period. And when that happened, immediately we saw an immediate reduction in the number of exploit attempts against Java inside the browser. And I'll show you a little bit more data here in a second. The other thing is people tend to worry about operating system exploits. And they always say, well, you know, Microsoft might only have 3% of industry vulnerabilities, but it's the operating system exploits that are the worst ones. And it's like, well, it's true. If there was an exploitable operating system exploit that didn't have a patch and that attackers actually were trying to exploit at scale, it would be terrible. But I haven't seen one of those in years, I gotta be honest. The one that you see here, this CPL link, this is the original one of the original vulnerabilities that they used in the Stuxnet worm. Okay, Stuxnet's how many years old now? Okay, so this was an example of a vulnerability with very low access complexity. It's trivial to try to exploit. Once they discovered the Stuxnet worm, and they discovered it because that worm went outside of the borders of Iran and started infecting all sorts of systems. Once they discovered that worm and the bad guys saw it and saw the vulnerability that was being exploited and how easy it was to exploit it, they baked that exploit into commodity malware that everybody gets infected with. And so today, this remains one of the top exploits that the bad guys try to exploit Windows systems with. And I say try because it's been patched for what, 5+ years? Every antivirus, every IDS, IPS system in the world knows how to block this. Okay, these are exploit attempts, right? These are encounters with this particular exploit that are being blocked by antivirus software. So again, it's really good to patch your Windows systems. You absolutely have to do it. But when it comes to risk, and risk, remember, is probability and impact. Okay, what's the probability of the threat being actually realized, and what's the impact if it is? Okay, this is something that I would describe as a low probability, high impact threat, right? If it actually was realized, it would be bad because the operating system would get compromised. But the probability has never been high compared to some of the other things that we should be paying attention to, and I'll walk you through some of that here. All right, so let's talk a little bit about, just trying to get this to advance, document exploits. I send you a Malform PDF file. You open it up with an old version of Adobe Reader that's not patched. Now you get owned. Now I download malware to your system, yada, yada, yada. Okay, you can see this going way, way down. Again, once the black hole exploit kit went out of commission, these types of threats started trending down and really haven't stopped. Plus, Adobe has gotten way better at updating Java or updating Adobe Reader and Acrobat than they were years ago. And they've been on a mission to eliminate or reduce vulnerabilities in these products. And so you can see that the attackers are really starting to wane in their use of this type of attack. Now, when there is a zero day in these products, all of a sudden you see everybody trying to use it, right? All of a sudden detections go way, way up unless it's extremely targeted. All right, so here we got Adobe Flash Player. Now, I'm showing you this because I mentioned that when Microsoft released that update to IE that blocked out-of-date ActiveX controls from loading, so all of a sudden, all the Java attacks went way, way down. What went way, way up? Flash. They immediately, within days, went from attacking Java runtime environment at scale to attacking Flash. And it didn't help that there were a few really bad Flash vulns during this period of time. But now, most of the data that we have shows that Flash is the new sort of ground zero, the place that you really should focus your attention. Because for many, many years, Flash was sort of dead from an attack perspective. You'd see the odd spike because of a zero day was found or something like this. But frankly, all the activity was on Java for the most part. And so now you can see when we released that update to Internet Explorer in the second quarter of 2014, bam, all of a sudden you can see Java starting to shrink and Flash starting to increase dramatically. All right, so we pay close attention to the, sir?
How is Flash typically attacked? The same, like a web page redirect?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So the question is, how is Flash typically attacked? When it's attacked at scale, It's usually through one of these drive-by download kits. Yeah, that's usually. But there are like zero-day, what they call waterhole attacks. So for instance, let's say I know that you're all developers and you work on networking. So I bring up a site that claims to have, you know, free code or free guidance, and I have a bunch of ratings that this is way better than, you know, this site over here, and I really build a community around it, and then over time I start to put in, you know, some of these exploits. You come in, your browser loads it up, bam. And so you see that from time to time as well. All right, so we pay attention to what's happening. How do these vulnerabilities get past the SDL, or how do these vulnerabilities get past Oracle and Adobe and all the other ones? How do these vulnerabilities make it into our products? So what we did is a 7-8 year study to look at where the vulns are in our products, and we specifically focused on the critical rated vulnerabilities in Microsoft products over these years. So these are just the critical vulns that actually enable remote code execution and are wormable theoretically. How did these get past the SDL? Where was the root cause? Okay, and you know, oftentimes when I go and I talk to people that have development organizations within the organization, I'll have somebody in charge of the development organization say, well, that's because you allow these trivial buffer overruns, like you guys use string cat and string copy. And it's like, you know, that's true back in like 2006, right? So back in 2006, we create Visual Studio, right? We manufacture that. We deprecated the libraries that allow unsafe calls, right? So all the C programming calls that we all learned in our C101 class or Programming 100 class, string copy, string cat, those have been eliminated in the compiler since 2006 at Microsoft. So we deprecated the old libraries, the original C libraries. Developers could no longer compile code with those libraries. We have safe versions of those libraries that actually forcefully terminate string copy, string cat, and all those things that lead to those unsafe buffer operations and lead to trivial stack overflows. And what happened? Lo and behold, we made that change in 2006. Now remember, we're dealing with millions and millions of lines of code that over time get recompiled. They don't all get recompiled the next day, right? We build Windows every day at Microsoft. But so here we go. Over a period of like 7 years, you finally see changes like that paying off, because finally in 2014 we got to the point where there were no stack-based exploits in critical rated Microsoft vulnerabilities for the first time ever. But it took 7 years of constantly looking at what the threats are doing, fixing the most common mistakes that developers make, making it harder and harder for the compiler to enable developers to make those mistakes, and so on. Now, today you can see where the money is. It's in the use after free bugs. It so happens that most of these types of bugs are in parsers like web browsers. So this is the most common mistake that we find today in Internet Explorer, Chrome, Safari, Firefox, and so on. And that's why last year, 2 years ago now, we had a Blue Hat contest. Does anyone remember the Blue Hat contest that we had in Las Vegas? We awarded, you know, three security developers over $250,000 in prize money because they specifically found mitigations to help mitigate, for instance, the RO type of bugs. So what we did... Return-oriented programming. The return-oriented programming, we had a bunch of classical bugs in there as well that were leading to these types of vulnerabilities. Three guys came out, entered the contest, all doing this return-oriented mitigations for us. They won the prize money. Those have since been implemented into Internet Explorer and other products so that we can actually try to avoid that type of threat in the future. All right, so this shows you the result of taking that approach using the SDL, releasing a new version of the SDL inside the company every 6 months based on where we see the threats going and what is actually exploitable, taking the exploitable out of the noise of the vulnerabilities, right? And you can see that between like 2011 and 2013, that's like a 70% reduction in exploitable critical rated vulnerabilities in Microsoft products. All right, so let's talk a little bit about malware, because once someone gets exploited, typically malware is installed on the system. We've got lots and lots of data on malware. Now, there's two measures that you'll see me talk about here. There's one called encounter rate that I've mentioned already. That is the percent of systems running real-time Microsoft antivirus software that encounter malware. So you're surfing the internet, you run across a drive-by download site, they try to download some malware onto your system, it's known malware, your antivirus software blocks it from getting installed. You get counted as an encounter. The other measure you see on the slide is called CCM, short for computers cleaned per mil, mil being a Latin term for 1,000. How many computers does the MSRT scan out of that 700 million every month, where we actually find malware infecting the system? Now, these are interesting statistics because oftentimes I'll ask crowds of people, so give me a guess on what you think the global average encounter rate is, right? And people are like, well, it's 100%. Everybody encounters malware, okay? But the reality is, the long-term trend is, it's about 20, 21, 19% of systems actually encounter malware in a 90-day period. Still a lot of systems, because you're talking between a billion and a half systems that encountered malware. Okay, but still, it's a lot lower than the 100% that I usually hear, especially amongst security professionals. The other thing I ask them is, what do you think the malware infection rate is globally? Because every country has a slightly different malware infection rate. Some are very, very high. Okay, I mentioned the war-torn countries like Syria, Iraq, Egypt, and so on. They tend to have really high malware infection rates because the public-private partnership that keeps the internet sort of safe starts to break down. People start to take a lot of risks moving data around on USB drives, which is one of the top ways to infect any system. So it turns out that the global average malware infection rate is about, in this case you can see down here, it's usually between 0.5% and 2.2%. 2.2% is the highest global malware infection rate that we've ever seen. Okay. Now, there's some places where we've seen extreme infection rates for short periods of time. So Qatar is an example. We saw Qatar's malware infection rate go up to 60, meaning that 60 computers were found to be infected with malware for every 1,000 we scan. But when you do the math, you see that even that isn't, you know, it's nowhere near 60%, right? It's more like 6%, which is a really high number. But it kind of reset your expectations about how many people are actually encountering malware globally, and then how many people actually get infected from an encounter. Obviously, and we have data on this that I'll get to, there's about 75% of the systems on the internet we know we're running real-time antivirus software from some vendor, because when the MSRT comes down and runs on the system every month, we actually check that to see whether they're running real-time antivirus software on that system, and we report that back. And so typically 75% are running real-time antivirus software, 25% are not. So it would seem like if 25% of the internet's not running AV and only 20% actually encounter malware, you would have a much smaller actual infection rate, probably people not running AV software, period. All right, so I mentioned countries have different characteristics when it comes to malware infection rates, and this is gets into a pretty deep topic that I've written a lot of blogs on, but usually the United States is where we find and clean the most malware. That might be, you know, again, and these numbers are normalized, so we're comparing 1,000 systems in the United States to 1,000 systems in Iraq to 1,000 systems in Switzerland. Usually we clean up 10 to 12.5 million systems in the United States of malware every 90 days. So that's a lot of systems, 12.5 million systems every 90 days. That's a lot of systems getting infected with malware. And then Brazil's typically always second place. They've been in the grips of a big crime wave there for many years, where the top, you know, five banks are being attacked by online attackers. We usually clean up 2.5 to 4 million systems there, and then it gets much smaller after that into the hundreds of thousands. So every country has a different story. A lot of these threats are what we call social engineering. They actually have to trick the user to get onto the system. And it turns out in order for them to do that, the attackers to trick someone to get them onto their system, they actually have to have the attack localized in the language of the person that's getting tricked, right? So if I only understand English and someone sends me something localized in Japanese and says, click on this link for joy forever, I'm out. I'm sorry, I'm never going to get exposed to that threat because I don't even know whether I should click on the link or I have no idea. I have no context. So a lot of these attacks, for instance, in Turkey, most of these attacks have some sort of social engineering aspect where the people doing the attacking understand Turkish language and Turkish culture, and that's what helps them make them successful. So these are encounter rates by country. The countries where we see people encounter malware most often: India, Pakistan, Malaysia, sometimes the Middle East. And these change very rapidly. It's not like this is the same all the time. And then the places that actually get infected with malware the most, again, the darker the color, the higher the malware infection rate. But you can see the Middle East. Places inside of Africa, we don't get enough data from a lot of those countries to be statistically significant. And so that's why we don't have good numbers there. It turns out in a lot of these countries, if you go off the continent with your web browser and download content that's hosted in another country, you have to pay your ISP to do that extra. So they don't tend to download security updates from the interior of Africa or go off the continent, so we don't tend to get very good data from there. All right, so places with high encounter rates, I mentioned Pakistan. You can see Vietnam is always in there as well, has been for years and years. Egypt, very interesting. Places with low encounter rates that encounter malware a lot less often than the worldwide average of about 19%. I call these guys the usual suspects. Okay, all these guys, the Scandinavian countries and Japan, they always have the least number of encounters, and they all also typically have the lowest malware infection rates in the world. So these are places with high malware infection rates. You can see significantly higher than the worldwide average. And check it out. Some of these places have quite a bit of military activity going on in them, right? Some of these places are war-torn countries. And I mention this because I've done some analysis on this, and it turns out that these changes, that typically I get a question, you know, at this point in the presentation, why are there differences, regional differences in malware infection rates? I can see you were going to ask me that question, right?
Of course.
All right. It's complicated. We did an analysis of 90 different socioeconomic factors. So GDP, inflation, unemployment, broadband penetration, mobile usage, Facebook usage, yada, yada, yada. And it turns out that places, it changes over time. So there's what we call a tipping point. There's some countries, typically developing countries, where they're building infrastructure to get onto the internet. So more and more people are getting on the internet all the time. In an environment like that, malware infection rates tend to ramp up. As they build out more infrastructure and more people get online, malware infection rates increase. In developed countries, what we tend to see, the more people get online, the lower the malware infection rates go. So it's quite different. What happens is, as they build out the infrastructure, sooner or later, the government's going to get involved and start to partner, do the public-private partnership thing to try to drive malware infection rates lower. And typically when that happens, you start to see them go over across what we call the tipping point, and the malware infection rates start to go down. So two countries that went through this recently are India and Brazil, where they had very, very high malware infection rates, building out internet infrastructure. As soon as they started to mature in that market, governments got involved, a lot of public-private partnership going on, all of a sudden malware infection rates start to drop down quite a bit. So I've done a lot of analysis on this. It turns out there's just a few, seven, eight different, turns out there's about 36 factors, socioeconomic factors, that have correlations to regional malware infection rates, but it's usually government stability and economic stability that have the biggest impact in the countries that I've studied this stuff on. All right, so these are the five places again, the usual suspects with the low malware infection rates. They consistently have low malware infection rates. I've been to them all, talked to a lot of people in these countries and said, hey, what are you doing differently from these other countries? Came up with a list of about eight things that countries with high malware infection rates could do that countries with low malware infection rates already do. And I'll give you the URL to the blog and you can have a look at that. Encounter rates. So there's different categories of malware, right? So some malware, for instance, Trojans, the Trojan is a piece of malware that says it's one thing, but it's really another. So it says it's a video, or the stereotypical example here is a Trojan downloader and dropper. You'll see that pink line there. These used to be popular back in 2007, and they've actually come back in vogue here recently. Oh, I'm out of time. Or did you just say 10 more minutes? So these things come in and out of vogue all the time. But what happens is they'll tell you, hey, you're trying to watch a video on a site, and Microsoft forgot to ship a video codec inside of Windows. So we know those guys can't get that right. You know, you haven't been able to watch video on Windows for the last 20 or 30 years. So you better go download this codec and install it on your system. And that's what we call a social engineering attack. You thought you were downloading and installing a video codec, but you were installing the worst Trojan downloader and dropper in the world, which will download more malware onto your system, enlist you into a botnet, and so on. All right, so I am out of time. I had a lot of stuff here to cover with you guys. We were going to talk about ransomware. Everyone likes to talk about ransomware. Operating systems, infection rates for operating systems. Different operating systems have different infection rates in different countries. It's very actually interesting to start to dig into this stuff. But newer is better. If you get on the newer stuff, there's definitely fewer vulnerabilities. There's definitely more security mitigations that make it harder to attack and so on. This is true on the server side as well as the client side. And so we've got lots of data in there. We talk about the top threats, consumer versus enterprise and so on, different types of threats in the consumer world and the enterprise world. All this data, by the way, it's not wasted because it's actually in the Microsoft Security Intelligence Report, and I'm going to get to the URL and leave you with that. I mentioned that we know how many systems out there have antivirus software installed on them. So here's three categories for you. The ones that don't have it are called unprotected. The ones that have it on but only once in a while, like for instance once or twice every 3 months, it turns out that those systems are as infected as the ones that are unprotected. So if you have AV but you turn it off because you're playing a game or something, or the trial period is up because you bought your system and it had trial AV and the trial expired, it turns out computers with expired trial antivirus software have higher malware infection rates because not only is the antivirus software not doing anything for you, but you've inherited all the vulnerabilities that they have inside the engine, which they're not patching for you either because, after all, the trial period's up. All right, so we have a bunch of data that will show you that, and I wanted to get to this. We also have guidance on how to protect yourself in the Security Intelligence Report. And I have to say that keeping systems updated, all software, is one of the most effective ways of keeping your system in a non-compromised state. But it's tough because you have to keep all your software updated, and there's a lot of vendors that won't give you updates for their software. So you have to go back and ask those folks for updates because their software is definitely not perfect. My favorite here is use caution when clicking on links and web pages. What that means is as you use the mouse and you go up to the URL to click on it, you want to gingerly click on the URL as opposed to just clicking on it with confidence. I got a little bit of laugh. Okay. Resources, Microsoft.com/serve for the report. Hundreds of pages of this stuff. My blog, you can see the Cyber Trust blog there. I do a lot of inside baseball and extra analysis on this stuff and write up on that blog. We have a Twitter account with a couple hundred thousand followers because we tweet some of this stuff out when we see it, so it might be useful to become a follower. Anyway, thank you very much for your time. Thank you for the extra time. It's been a pleasure. Oh, we got one question. One question. Right.
Any insights in how long malware persists?
Sure. So the first question was, what's the malware infection rate essentially on out of support systems? The challenge with getting malware infection rate for out of support systems, and we've seen this with Windows 2000 all the way to Windows XP, is that once the systems go out of support, even when we offer those systems the MSRT to find out if they're being infected, the bad guys will immediately, once they get on that box, start to do things with rootkits and hook the APIs that the antivirus software uses in the first place. So what ends up happening is you'll see that the malware infection rate sort of freeze at a level, and that's it. So with some of the old operating systems, it actually went down to almost nothing. And that's always a bad thing, because when an operating system goes out of support and it has, you know, in the case of XP, lots of publicly available exploits for publicly known vulnerabilities at this point, it's not more secure than it was when it was being patched. And so it's very hard for us to get an accurate number, because the bad guys immediately start hooking the APIs that all antivirus software uses. So we can't really tell. The other question was longevity. Yeah. So I can tell you that when a system gets infected, we've done a study where what we call the parent and child study, where once a piece of malware gets on the system, then we look at what it downloads next and what they download next and that type of thing. It turns out that when a system gets infected with malware, it's like 2.2 pieces of malware infecting that system. I mean, it's amazing. It's very close to, you know, the 2.4 kids here in the United States. Anyway, so once those get onto the system, it really depends whether they have antivirus software, and it also depends on whether those are known threats. So what the bad guys are doing is they're using what's called server-side polymorphism. So every time they serve up a new piece of malware to another system, they're slightly tweaking that binary to avoid detection from the antivirus companies. And so once they get on your system, we've seen them update the malware on the systems 6, 7, 8, 1,000 times a day. And that makes it hard for antivirus companies. See, they've even turned off my mic at this point. That makes it hard for antivirus. They really want me to leave here. Okay, anyway, you get my point.
How long?
I don't have a number for you. There's some things that you don't know that you know you don't know what you don't know, right? So, in our case, one of the distinguishing factors between enterprise grade antivirus software is the time to release a new signature, right? So in a lot of the standard industry tests that I've seen, it's usually 8 hours, but it depends on how many times they're releasing signatures. So for instance, with consumer grade antivirus, I've seen usually it's about once every 24 hours they'll release a signature. So if you don't get it in that signature release, it's gonna be yet another 24 hours. Now, all the AV companies trade samples with each other over time to make sure that no one is missing a threat or a threat family. So over a period of time, all the AV companies will know about all of the threats. So the real difference is the number of false positives and how often they're releasing signature updates. And so with enterprise-grade antivirus, it's usually at Microsoft, it's usually between, you know, 2 to 6 times a day, depending on what's happening. So that's why they release it so often, is because they want to make sure that if a threat does get on the system that they don't already know about, they quickly remediate that. So it should be less than 24 hours in most cases, right? It should be less than, you know, because they're trading samples every single day with every antivirus company out there. So anyway, that's aspirationally what it's supposed to be anyway. All right.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
Thanks.